You're listening to the On the NBA Beat podcast, a show packed with nuanced perspectives on the league's most important stories.
Portland has three timeouts left. The Lakers have two. Bryant to Shaq.
LeBron James with no regard for human life.
Jordan.
Oh, a spectacular move by Michael Jordan.
And now, your hosts, Lauren Lee Chen and the twins, Aaron and Joshua Fishman.
Welcome in. This is Aaron. Shortly, I'll be joined by Lauren and our guest this edition, John Corrales. He's the Celtics beat writer for Boston Sports Journal, host of Locked On Celtics, and author of the Boston Celtics All-Time All-Stars. The first and only other time John appeared on the NBA beat, a couple days before New Year's Day 2016, we were in our inaugural season of the podcast. At the time, neither of the Celtics' top two players was even in the NBA. More than 5 months earlier, Jason Tatum had committed to Duke, and at the time we recorded with John, Tatum was in the midst of his senior high school season in St. Louis, Missouri. Meanwhile, Jaylen Brown was 13 games through his lone collegiate season in Berkeley, and just about to begin the Pac-12 portion of Cal's schedule. Brown and Tatum, respectively, would be drafted third overall by the Boston Celtics in the following two drafts, and go on to improve progressively ever since. At present, they have the Celtics one win from eliminating the star-studded Brooklyn Nets to advance to the Eastern Conference semifinals. During the regular season, these Celtics recorded the league's second-best net rating, just narrowly behind the Phoenix Suns, despite finishing tied for the sixth-best wins-loss record due to losing most of their closest games. In round one against Brooklyn, Boston has resolved that problem, winning the first game on a buzzer-beating layup and pulling away from the Nets in the fourth quarters of games two and three. Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, both logging heavy minutes, have been corralled by a stifling Celtics defense. Now that the context has been set, let's bring in our terrific guest, Celtics beat reporter John Corrales. John, it's been a while. That's our fault, but it's a pleasure to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. It's good to be back.
Yeah, it's been too long. Boston is in an exciting position right now. As of recording time, they lead the Brooklyn Nets 3-0. There was a concern going into the series just about Boston's inability to close tight games. They actually won just 3 of 9 regular season contests decided by 3 points or fewer. That's the worst mark of any playoff team this season other than the Jazz. Meanwhile, the Nets won 8 of 12 such games. You referred to it as chokers in the clutch, them being that in your title, in the latest article you wrote for Boston Sports Journal. How have they been able to flip the script so far in this series?
Well, I think part of it is having learned lessons from these losses that they've had in the past. This team does actually learn. And that's something that, you know, there was some question at the beginning of the season, but I think now, especially with context, you can tell that some of the things earlier in the season you can chalk up to health, where they, like most teams, were hit by COVID. But they were hit by COVID at the very beginning of the season in training camp. And, you know, Jaylen Brown and Al Horford were both out. And then Jaylen, you know, hurts a hamstring and he's out for a bit. And then, you know, you factor in Dennis Schroeder being a ball stopper. And when they signed Schroeder, I thought, you know, not a big deal. It doesn't even matter if he doesn't fit. You have him for a little bit. You trade him at the deadline. You get something useful and you move on. And that's in the wide view, the 30,000 foot view. That's what happened when you skim past a lot of the things that he did wrong. But that was a tough thing for them to recover from because he really, really didn't fit. To a lesser degree, Josh Richardson, who played well. But I mean, it feels like a lifetime ago that Josh Richardson was on this team. So getting the guys in regular roles, you know, learning those hard lessons, understanding what needed to be done in these clutch moments, playing the way Ime wants them to play, moving the ball, sharing the ball, and most importantly, defending at an extraordinarily high level. That's what got them to this place. And in this series, they are not letting Kevin Durant close out. They are not letting Durant get going and start to do all the things that Durant does. Like when the Nets are closing out teams, it's Durant just bucket after bucket after bucket, mid-range after mid-range after mid-range, unstoppable. In this series, they've frustrated the hell out of him. They've beaten him up, and he's throwing passes to nobody now. And that's just a testament to the guys being on the same page, understanding what they're trying to accomplish, and executing it to the highest level.
Yeah, and we'll definitely be sure to spend a lot of time on that dominant defensive effort we've seen through the first three games. But just based off of what we saw from Jason Tatum in game three, I felt like we had to do one early question about his virtuoso performance. It was pretty incredible. 39 points, 6 steals. In doing so, he became the first player in Celtics playoff history to record a 35-5-5-5 game. He's getting to the line a lot more than he did. He's racking up the assists. How special was that Saturday performance? And does the rest of the league stand any chance of slowing him or the Celtics down when he's rolling like that?
I mean, it's going to be tough. There's no doubt about that. It'd be tough to stop him in, when he's got it going, he could be as deadly as anybody in the league. But the thing about Tatum that stands out, it's two things. It's the steals. If you're looking for statistical things, the steals and the assists are the biggest indication of what Tatum has become. Because he's always been like a willing defender, but he's now in this series, he is the primary guy on Durant. That says a lot, because normally you don't get your number one guy as your number one defender. And he's out there taking on the Durant matchup and playing it really well. Now they switch a lot, so he's not the only one. Grant Williams has done a phenomenal job defensively in this series. Marcus Smart, obviously, Jaylen Brown, everybody, Horford, Tice, everybody's had some level to play in this. But Tatum taking on that challenge, doing it well, and finding his way into passing lanes, making steals, blocking shots, it's been really amazing. And then his willingness to pass just opens everything up, because if he's passing, then that means that Tice and Horford and Robert Williams, now that he's back, those are the guys that are going to start going off and really killing you, because you have to pay so much attention to Tatum, and he's got guys that are willing and capable to go in there and make the hard shot. It's not like Bruce Brown, where the Celtics defense is kind of geared towards living with those kinds of shots. It's the Celtics role players are giving Tatum this opportunity to burn the Nets. And, I asked Ime Udoka after the game about Tatum, and he says it's that willingness that, earlier this season where Tatum didn't make teams pay. Going back to your first question, when Tatum didn't make teams pay for blitzing him, that's when they were giving up leads. That's when they were losing the close games. It's Tatum being willing to say, okay, you want to put two on me? Let me just draw the two of you out. Let me give the ball up. And, you're going to have to play 4-on-3 for a couple of seconds. And 4-on-3 with Jaylen Brown and three other Celtics is not going to go well for you. So making that the case, that really elevates Tatum's game. And then he can just go off on his individual shooting over smaller defenders, taking slower defenders to the rim, all of that stuff. It's a complete package for him now.
Yeah, he's really putting it all together. And you rightly focused a lot on the defense in your response. The Celtics, just as a whole, they certainly have the personnel to play clampdown defense. Marcus Smart, we'll get more to him later, of course, Defensive Player of the Year. Jaylen Brown, Al Horford, Robert Williams now is back, and the list goes on. And they proved that during the regular season with a league best 106.2 defensive rating. But what they've done on that end through the first three games against two of the league's most elite offensive talents, I think is nothing short of extraordinary. Durant is regarded as one of the best all-time playoff offensive players, one of the best offensive players of all time, period. I don't even think I needed to say in the playoffs. So I'm just going to list a few stats that stood out to me, just some basic ones that are really telling. They limited Irving and Durant to a combined 1 of 17 shooting in the second half of the Game 2 victory. They somehow held Kevin Durant to 4 of 17 from the field in Game 2. They forced 17 Kevin Durant turnovers over the first three games. When Durant's been on the court, and that's been for 40-plus minutes each game, the Nets have been outscored by 25 points. I think that just says it all. Of course, also Boston really bounced back defensively against Kyrie Irving after his game one 39-point outburst. He was held to just 10 points and one assist in 40 minutes of game two. There's a lot of course, I guess you could say extracurricular or off-court stuff involving Kyrie Irving. Like, for instance, the incident with the crowd where he flipped off fans near the court was fined $50,000, and he's fasting during Ramadan with some exception from sunrise to sunset. So there are all these other factors that could be playing some role. I'm curious from your perspective, from a game planning standpoint, and also just how much of those factors that I just cited could have to do with the struggles we've seen from Kyrie. I know you've covered him a couple of seasons in Boston, and so you know him well.
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to Kyrie struggling, I wouldn't even say necessarily that he's struggling. He had that one great game. He didn't hit a three in this game, so I don't know. Maybe I should rescind my I don't think he's struggling. He got decent looks. He got 17 shots. He should be making those at a higher percentage. He did have 9 assists, so he's putting in the effort. Now, game two, he did not. And after the game in game two, he seemed like he was in postseason mode on the podium. I don't know. It's hard for me to explain Kyrie. That's kind of like how do you do that?
I also said you know him well, but it's hard to know him, isn't it?
It is hard to know him. I mean, I covered him, and here's what I know about him. One day, you get one Kyrie. The next day, you get a different Kyrie. And it depends on his mood. And the, you know, what you saw in game one, him playing up to the crowd and flipping people off, like, I don't know, that seemed to fuel him a little bit. Game two, like, I don't know what it was. Like, okay, yeah, he got fined $50,000. Okay, who cares? I mean, it's $50,000. It's easy for me to say with, you know, Kyrie, but it's still like, you know, he's making a ton of money. So that's like fining me $5.
Yeah.
So I don't know, man. I think what we're seeing here is just, I got to give the credit to the Celtics defense. And it's as simple as that. Like the Celtics defense, the switching has I think taken them out of their rhythm. And when Kevin Durant is out of rhythm, then the whole thing starts to fall apart. Because Kyrie plays off of Kevin Durant. And it's not the other way around. It's Kyrie playing off of KD, and KD needs to be like destroying teams for everybody to overreact. And then Kyrie can go in and kind of like be the guy that hits the last few shots. I look at game three and I say, Bruce Brown got 19 field goal attempts and Kevin Durant got 11 field goal attempts. And to me, that tells the story of the Celtics defense more than any of these other stats, the steals, the turnovers, Kyrie's numbers, KD's number, that one number. Bruce Brown had 8 more field goal attempts than Kevin Durant is everything you need to know, because that's how much they're limiting him. And if Bruce Brown is the guy that's going to go off, then what does that what opportunity does that give Kyrie to go off? Like, it doesn't give those guys any opportunity at all to be who they are and what makes them special. So again, I got to credit Grant Williams, especially because he's done such a good job bodying Kevin Durant, playing physical, playing like a big, and just using his strength over and over and over again on Durant. And then he'll switch on to Kyrie Irving. And that should be, it feels like when you say, well, Grant Williams switched on Kyrie Irving, stop talking. I know how this story ends. It's like, no, actually he's staying right in front of Kyrie and has been doing an unbelievable job of staying in front of him, keeping his hands up, not letting Kyrie go off and go crazy. And like when the Celtics have big, versatile guys, length, speed, lateral quickness, you take away, you cut off the head of the snake, so to speak. And, you know, even Kyrie getting like for a stretch there, Kyrie was keeping Brooklyn in game three. And it didn't matter. It just didn't matter because the Celtics never felt like they were out of control of game three.
Yeah, and also, as we mentioned before, Marcus Smart won the Defensive Player of the Year award, first guard to win that award since Gary Payton. A lot of people were questioning whether he deserved to win that award over guys like Rudy Gobert, Jaren Jackson Jr., plenty of other candidates this season. But we've seen the defensive effort from the Celtics this year, and people view him as sort of, you know, the best defensive player on the best defensive team, even if it is a strong team defense. But how would you say he convinced people that he earned that reward and how he anchors the Celtics defense?
Yeah, I think so. The way you phrased it is correct. Best defensive player on the best defensive team. I've seen people make the argument that he didn't get the award until he started campaigning for it. He's been campaigning for this award for 4 years. So that's not the case. What happened was the Celtics went from 18-21 in the 11th seed to 51-31 and the second seed. And they did it behind an elite defense, historically good defense. And so right around the time that was happening, you had other candidates like Gobert on a Utah team that had a reputation for falling apart in the fourth quarter. And their defense was middle of the pack. So you can say he's an elite defender, and he is. If he won Defensive Player of the Year, I mean, some people would have been upset, but like, I think most people would be like, yeah, well, I mean, he still is that great of a player. But when your team is a middle of the pack defensive team, I think it's fair to say, well, how great are you if you're not raising the level of this team defense? And I think Marcus Smart, I've also seen the argument made that he doesn't. And that's just not true because everybody on this team will tell you that Smart is the defensive leader. He organizes that defense. He knows everything that's coming from the other team. His IQ, his basketball IQ is incredibly high. He will be on guys when they make a mistake or when something happens and there's a miscommunication. He's the guy defensively that gets them together. He understands what's supposed to happen. And he's a vocal leader. So I feel like on the court, just his ability to switch one through five has been, pretty elite. I don't know any other way to say it, but he definitely deserves the award. At the same time, there are probably three other guys that you can say, well, they also deserve the award, and that's true. But only one guy can win it, and they went with the best defensive player on the best defensive team. And frankly, I think what voters really wanted to do was give it to Draymond Green, but he didn't play enough games. And Golden State's defense was up there as well. And that probably was if they had stayed up at the top or near the top, that would have been so Draymond focused that he would have easily won the award. But it's a weird year. It was a weird year with the way things went. And, you know, that's why you get what some people would call a weird result with a guard winning it. But he's a guard that deserves it and worked hard. And just one of those things, like the local beat writer sees, you know, the local beat writer for the Utah Jazz going to just argue till he's blue in the face for Gobert, because you see every little tiny bit. I've watched every ounce of every second of Marcus Smart playing basketball this year, multiple times in many cases. And so I see the work that he's put in. And I think he's a worthy award winner.
And speaking again about the difference between the first half and the second half of the regular season, even beyond the first half, because they were, as you said, three games under 500 as late as early January, 25-25 after 50 games before ending the season on a 26-6 run in their last 32 games. Did anything in particular click for the Celtics, or even from a coaching standpoint, if anything changed over the course of Ime Udoka's first year as head coach of this team?
Well, I think a couple of things happened. One that I alluded to before, which was the trade deadline, where out goes Schroeder, out goes Richardson, in comes Derek White and Daniel Theis. And also, they got healthy. So right around the same point of the season, mid-January, those few weeks, you had Marcus Smart being the actual point guard of this team. At the beginning of the season, when guys were out, they would start Dennis Schroeder and move Smart off ball. And moving Smart off ball is just, it's not a good spot for him. He just doesn't, you know, I think he came into the season wanting to be the team's point guard. He came into this league wanting to be the team's point guard. And he's bided his time because he just happened to be playing on a team with Isaiah Thomas and Kyrie Irving and, Kemba Walker. And so now it was his time. And then they bring in Schroeder, and it's like, well, okay, now this now? So I think Marcus was pissed at the beginning of the season, and he wrote it out as the starting point guard. I just think Marcus is so good as the starting point guard with this team. We just talked about defensive player of the year. Offensively, I think he's been really good for this team, setting people up. He has a great chemistry with Robert Williams. He just kind of understands the pace that Ime wants to play at. That's part one. Starting five is settled. Part two is with Derek White and Daniel Tyson, but mostly Derek White as far as the regular season goes. You had a ball mover. You had a guy who understood the San Antonio 0.5 basketball. You got a half a second. Catch it, move it. Catch it, shoot it. Catch it, dribble it. Whatever you're going to do, just do it. Do it right away. Make the next right play. And Derek White understands that and does that. That's how he plays. That suddenly now you go, okay, the ball's not stopping when somebody else is on the floor. Like when Schroeder used to come in, sorry to pick on Dennis Schroeder all this time, but you know, he would, one of his hallmarks is just letting the ball roll up the floor before he picks it up. Like all you're doing is letting the defense get set and rest while you're doing that. So moving the ball was a huge thing. And then the final element was everybody buying in to what Ime was trying to get them to do. And especially Jason Tatum. They had a lot of evidence by the time January rolled around. They had a lot of evidence of, hey, when you want to ISO and you guys don't play the way I want to tell you, you're losing. When you want to move the ball and draw two and give the ball up and then let the rest of the guys play four on three and burn the other team, then we're winning. And that message got through. And Tatum's game changed right around that same time, and he's become a tremendous facilitator. And everybody's just kind of, I know it's cliche to say they bought in, but I think that's the best way to put it, because they figured it out. They figured out what the coach has been trying to tell them. They figured out that it works when they do it the way he's been saying. And everything just kind of happened at the same time. And so that's why I was pushing hard for Ime to get some coach of the year consideration, because I know other guys made it that they had more consistent seasons, and Monty Williams certainly deserves the award. But I've never seen an in-season turnaround like this that was so reliant on, oh, this is coaching. Coaching the defense got it together. They did what they wanted to. Coaching the players, the individuals, they started to do what they wanted to do. Like all of that stuff centers around everything clicking for them. So between health and better fits on the roster and everything kind of coming together, clicking, them buying in, that's why we're looking at this Celtics team right now and not the one that was blowing 20-point leads in the fourth quarter.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more show.
The NBA playoffs means next level basketball. Get in on the first round action with DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. This week, new customers can bet $5 on any team to win and get $150 in free bets instantly. You win no matter what. All DraftKings Sportsbook customers can also bet during the first round with same game parlays. Combine multiple bets from the same game for a bigger payout. The more legs you add, the more money you can win. Plus, place a same-game parlay each day with three or more legs and get up to $25 in free bets back if one leg doesn't hit. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Use promo code TBPN. Bet $5 on any NBA team to win their game during the first round of the playoffs and get $150 in free bets instantly. That's promo code TBPN at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. Minimum age and eligibility restrictions apply. See show notes for details.
This is Jared Weiss of The Athletic, and I'm on the NBA beat.
Speaking specifically about the addition of Derek White, he averaged around 11 points per game and 27 and a half minutes per game in the regular season after the Celtics acquired him. But it seems like his role has been a little bit reduced in this series. Do you view that as more matchup based, especially with Peyton Pritchard having strong games, especially in games 2 and 3, and Derek White possibly returning to a larger role in future rounds?
Yeah, I think right now with the playoffs, everybody understands like whatever works, right? And so if Pritchard is the guy that comes in and can hit some shots, then great. He was huge in game 2 with 10 points, or I think it was 8 in the fourth quarter of game 2 to kind of fuel that fourth quarter turnaround for the Celtics. I think it doesn't matter who it is. It could be Luke Kornet coming in off the bench. And if Luke Kornet suddenly gives the Celtics a 14-0 run and Al Horford is sitting on the bench, then so be it. Everybody's just going to understand like whatever works, we're going to do. And I think Derek White's goal is to play team basketball. He's been there. He understands the Ime Udoka system, how much of it's based on the San Antonio system. He understands the next right play. He's a very smart player, but he's also not a great shooter. And if the series needs shooting and Pritchard's the guy who's going to be hitting the shots, then great. I think Derek White is ready to play 40 minutes or 4 minutes. And at the end of the game, he's going to be happy if they get the win.
Yeah, and the role players for the Celtics in this series have been stepping up, especially Pritchard. And as we've mentioned before, Grant Williams, post-game after game 2, Jaylen Brown had the quote, "Grant and Peyton, they were our heroes tonight." Specifically, there was a brilliant stretch for Grant Williams at the end of the first half of game 2 where he had 8 straight points, including 2 threes, and then a block that helped really keep the game within reach and allow them to mount that amazing comeback that they did. And then Pritchard ended that game with a team-high plus 15 in plus-minus despite playing under 15 minutes. How valuable have the role players, Williams, Pritchard, Derek White when he's played, and then also, I guess, guys like Tice as well and Robert Williams as well, now that he's come back, have those contributions been for the Celtics?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so starting with Grant, that stretch, I love to say that clutch baskets don't all happen in the fourth quarter. So that stretch from Grant Williams was clutch. At the end of the first quarter, beginning of the second, he had 3 3-pointers. That was a 16-point game that was starting to get away from the Celtics. He comes in, and after he hits that last 3-pointer, it's a 6-point game and very manageable. That is as clutch as you're going to get, because now the Celtics play the second quarter even, and then the third quarter they make some progress, and then in the fourth quarter they run away with game two. And you trace that all the way back to Grant hitting those 3 3-pointers to span the first and second quarters. I've already mentioned the defense. He's been phenomenal defensively. I really can't say enough about his defense. And I think nationally that might be getting lost because Smart won Defensive Player of the Year and just the way the series is going. But defensively, he's been maybe the most valuable Celtic in a way, because that's supposed to be a weak link and he hasn't been at all. And then, yeah, when Derek White comes in, all you're looking to do is make the right play. And that pass that he threw to Jason Tatum in the third quarter of game three, that full court pass was just, you talk about 0.5. This dude grabbed a rebound, turned, saw Tatum had a step on Bruce Brown. He just caught the ball and immediately it was gone. And that ball went 90 feet in the air and hit Tatum square in the palm in stride. That was an amazing pass. Plays like that, all you need to do is make one or two plays like that, that can swing a game, that can change the momentum. So he's been doing well when he's come in, even though his contributions don't show up necessarily all the time in the box score. Peyton, his shooting has been great. All of these guys, now Robert Williams is coming back. He's going to be, I think, super. And you already see in limited time that he can make a tremendous defensive impact. And yeah, shout out to Daniel Tice, who slid right in for 3 games so far when Rob went down. Aside from a game one where he was just playing way too far off the ball in their pick and roll coverage, they fixed that. They made that adjustment. He's playing much higher up at the level of the screen. And that allows the Celtics to just be a little bit more aggressive and trapping. Once they made that adjustment, the defense really tightened up and you got away from that big Kyrie Irving explosion. So the role players have done their jobs. I mean, it's kind of wild because I asked Ime before we had Zoom calls before we started recording this. And one of my questions was, I know the plan is working, but is the plan working better than you thought? Because it feels like this is going pretty perfectly. And he wouldn't say it, but you could tell in his inflection, he's like, yeah, it's going well. He's not saying like, oh, it's going perfect, because he doesn't want to disrespect the other team and he doesn't want to like sound cocky. But you could see he's like, I'm just going to say it's going well. You guys can make your judgments on your own. So everybody is doing their job. And it's been an amazing 3 games.
On the offensive side of the ball for Boston, it seems like, especially when Brown and Tatum are on the floor together, the Celtics have consistently been able to hunt out the defensive mismatches, regardless of who Brooklyn has on the floor. It always seems like there's someone who they can find as a defensive liability, be it Seth Curry, Patty Mills, Goran Dragic, the surprising return of Blake Griffin in game 3. To what extent do you think Brooklyn just doesn't have the defensive personnel to stay with the Celtics, especially when the two Jays are there? And also, it's been rumored that for game 4 on Monday that they might be able to bring back Ben Simmons to make mm-hmm. his debut. And what impact might he have on that side of the floor?
So, I mean, when this season started, I said Celtics in 5. And I think people dismissed Celtics in 5 because they said, well, you're a Celtics guy. Of course you're going to. But I said Celtics in 5 because of that defense that you brought up. When the Nets have the ball there's really no weak link to pick on, right? You can switch across. If they've been closing with Grant Williams on the floor, and it's been Smart, Jalen, Jason, Grant, and Al Horford. Who do you target in that configuration? Target Grant Williams? Well, like I just said and have been saying, he's been amazing defensively. He bodies up Kevin Durant. He doesn't let him catch the ball clean. He's been able to stay laterally with Kyrie Irving. So that's not working. And so you can't pick on anybody. Horford's able to slide and stay with guards. Durant's getting his butt kicked, you know, every time he touches the ball. So there's no real weak link for them to target. Now on the other side, the Celtics can, you know, pick your poison. Kyrie, terrible defender, especially in game three when he has five fouls. Seth Curry, terrible defender. Goran Dragic, terrible. Blake Griffin, terrible. And now you have multiple guys on the floor. And Kevin Durant is so worn out that he can't be the defensive presence, the rim protector that he's supposed to be. That is why I thought from the beginning that they don't have it defensively. These two teams can battle all game long, and it would have been, it's either going to be four or five or however many games it's going to be. They're all tough games, but I never saw Brooklyn with the ability to stop the Celtics. And I always saw the Celtics being able to kind of get whatever shot they wanted in switches against a heavily switching team like the Brooklyn Nets. It seemed very simple to me. And now you want to throw Ben Simmons into that mix? Okay. A guy who hasn't played all, you know, in a year. And, you know, he might come in with a ton of energy and you say, oh my God, he's going to lock up Jason Tatum. Like, okay, so are you not switching anymore? Are you guys playing straight up? Because then Tatum will just be like, all right, fine, go play 4-on-4. I'm going to stand here at the corner up by half court, and we got Jaylen Brown on our team, and Jaylen Brown's going to go pick you guys apart. So what are you going to switch him onto Jaylen Brown? Like, where are you going to put him? It doesn't make sense to throw Ben Simmons. It's not like he's Brook Lopez, right? Where Brook won a championship with the Milwaukee Bucks, has been a part of them building that defense, and he missed the whole season, and he comes in, and all of a sudden it's like, wow, Brook looks really good. Yeah, because he doesn't have to work on the chemistry. He needs to knock off a little rust, but he knows how to play with those guys. Ben Simmons has never played a second with this team. He's on a new team. He hasn't played all year, so he hasn't played at game speed, and now you're going to throw him into a playoff series against a very physical Celtics team with multiple offensive options, and think that they're just not going to send pick after pick after pick and force you to switch. I assume Brooklyn is going to still employ its same defensive principles and switch. So, all right, you want to start Ben Simmons on Tatum? All right, here comes Marcus Smart, who's being guarded by Kyrie Irving, to set a pick. And now you got Kyrie on Tatum. Do you think that Ime Udoka is going to forget how to switch? Like, I just don't understand. I don't understand all of this, what people are thinking, the whole, all you need is 15 good minutes. Like, no, that's not how it works defensively. That's not how it works. And I don't understand how people who allegedly know basketball are actually going on TV and saying, well, you know, it could, like, no, just be honest. That's not how this works.
That's good to get that little bit of dose of reality from you. As we wind down, I just want to shift for a second just to, I don't know if you'd call it animosity between the two teams. There's certainly no love lost between them. They're meeting in the first round of the playoffs for the second straight season. Of course, Brooklyn dispatched Boston in five games last year. The Celtics were without Jaylen Brown, and Durant, Irving, and Harden all had phenomenal series. And also there's the Kyrie Irving development. Let's just say he's not too well liked in Boston. I'm not going to say more than that.
We can go ahead and make that assumption.
I'm just going out on a limb there. But I'd love to hear what the players are saying. A lot of times there's this tendency to be diplomatic and say it's just business as usual, nothing personal about it. Do you sense any heightened level of emotion or just wanting it that much more? Or is it just another series you got to go out there and play and advance?
I'll be honest, these guys are very, very businesslike. it's been wild to see. Like, there's no added emotion. There's no added, you know, we've got to do this or that to these guys, or no side swipes, no random kind of like, ooh, that seems like a thinly veiled shot. Like, none of that. None of that. The Celtics, the guys on the Celtics still like Kyrie, despite what fans want to say. Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, all of those guys, whenever Kyrie has come back to Boston or whenever they've met, they sit there before the game and talk. They sit there after the game and talk. They're cool. They're all cool. And, you know, Kevin Durant, Jason Tatum have a great relationship. They, you know, that's been developed on Team USA. These guys respect each other. They're doing what two great players and two, you know, great teams are doing when you actually respect one another. And that's go hard at each other. If you're a competitor and it's me and you, and we're both competitors and we're saying, okay, let's go. The best way I can show you respect is to give you everything that I have. And you give me everything that you have. And then at the end, the winner wins and the loser loses. And you hug and say, oh, you got me, or I got you. And like, that's it. I played my hardest basketball against my friends. You know, I went harder against my teammates than I would against opponents, because I always respected them. And in games, whenever there was another guy who, like, by the end of the game, we just like beat the hell out of each other, I'd always seek that guy after the game and be like, yes, thank you. Thank you for giving me everything that you have. That's the mentality that you have to have in sports. And so you see guys like Durant and Tatum want to kill each other on the court. And then afterwards, they'll like hug and say, like, that's what I want from you. I want you to show me what you got. I'll show you what I got. And the winner gets to walk off with their head held high. And then the loser walks off and you like got to work on stuff. So I think this is two teams with a lot of mutual respect.
Yeah. This will be the last question before we let you go, John. And thanks a lot for spending so much time delving into this team and this series with us. In NBA history, no team has ever come back from a 3-0 deficit to win a best of seven playoff series. But as we know, the Brooklyn Nets are not your typical playoff team that gets down 3-0, and you certainly don't want to count your chickens before they're hatched. Is there any doubt in your mind that the Celtics will be able to close this out in short order? Or what adjustments would the Nets have to make to stop that from happening?
Well, they need to make Seth Curry taller. They need to make Goran Dragic younger. Aside from that, I don't think they've got much. This is really tough for Brooklyn because now it's one day off between games. And like I said before, Celtics have been cutting Durant's legs off all series. He has no legs left. And I think you just hear the tone from Brooklyn after game three. I think they all understand, like, this thing is over. This thing is over. KD was talking about, we've got one more game. No, you don't have one more game. You have the next game and potentially three more if you really can get it. But he's talking like, it's just those little things of saying, okay, it's one more game. All right, well then, great. You know, Ime today said, summed it up really, really well. He said, I'm not the kind of guy that counts things as done until they're done. And he said, Ray Allen took a championship away from me my first year coaching. So I always have that in my mind. So that mentality is a great one to have. And I think Ime has his players' ears. And so they understand, like, you got one more game to win. You didn't come here to mess around and give them life. You came here to end the series. And I would expect, if in the first 5 minutes of this game four, if the Celtics come out with strong intensity, a run, like if they go up like 20-8, then this series is over. Brooklyn can just pack it up, make your travel plans, go to Cancun or wherever, and just be done with it. And I think they're very willing to be done with it. They just need one last push. And I think the Celtics, I could be wrong, I think the Celtics are very willing to give them that last push.
John, it's been a pleasure catching up with you. Thanks again for taking the time, joining us from the road, and good luck to you and the Celtics from here on out.
Appreciate it. Thanks, you guys, for having me back. Looking forward to the next time.
Huge thanks again to John Corrales for joining us this episode. If you want to read and listen to more of John's thoughts on the Celtics, you can find him on Twitter at @John_Corrales, on the Locked On Celtics podcast, and on the Boston Sports Journal. All links in the show notes. This episode was hosted, edited, and produced by me, Lauren Lee Chen, and Aaron Fishman, whom you can follow on Twitter at Lauren L. Chen and at @ByAaronFish, respectively. If you liked what you heard, you can subscribe for more episodes by searching On the NBA Beat wherever you get your podcasts. And if you feel so inclined, it'd be much appreciated if you dropped a 5-star rating and review while you're there. On the NBA Beat is part of the Basketball Podcast Network.